So last time we defined what a sheaf was on some topological space, and we defined it both as an Attal bundle and as a special type of. Doesn't matter if you don't have an ID. Your name is. They'll find you with your name, I suppose, right? It'd work. Okay, so we defined what a sheaf was both in terms of a special type of presheaf, which had some consistency conditions, so that the topology on the topological space was respected when mapped to the bundle space. And we also defined in terms of Attali bundles. And we found out that there was a way of mapping presheaves first to bundles. And this we did through this equivalence classes of germs. And then we mapped them to sheaves. So for each presheaf, you would get the bundle. And then you would get the sheaf of sections on that bundle. Now, because sheaves are actually a special case of presheaves, then if this guy here was actually a sheaf, then this entire process would be just an isomorphism. And moreover, we saw that if the bundle is Attal, then you can go to sheaves. Oops. And this was an equivalence of categories. Okay, this is just a summary, really. Now, it turns out that these are functors, and they're special type because they're adjoint. I'll explain later what this is. So this is left adjoint to this guy. In very kind of superficial words, what it means is that the way they map the structure from one to another is such that, a lot of the structure is preserved when going from one to another. So in fact, adjoints are kind of, they're very important. You have adjoint pairs in pretty much a lot of situations in topos theory. And in fact, if you do have a functor between two categories, you would want it to be adjoint to some other functor, precisely because this adjoint relation preserves the structures when mapping from one category to another. But we're going to do this in a bit. First, I want to say a few words, still on sheaves, but on sheaves sheaves that interest us. So far, we have defined all our topos construct in terms of presheaves over this category. Now, we want to define groups and probabilities, we want to go to sheaves over that category. So we somehow want to go from presheaves to sheaves. Now, in order to do that, you can do all that process, but it turns out that we're lucky. And the reason is that this category here already has a topology, and it's an Alexandrov topology. So, and this is because it's a poset. So each poset automatically comes equipped with what is called Alexandrov. Topology. And what is it? So we'll take this category here. So a basis for, I'll just write Alex, yeah? Topology is the collection of all downward sets. So for each V, you simply take all the downward sets, all the subalgebras of that V. And this is a basis for an Aleksandrov topology. So being a post set, you can always define lower sets. And the collection of these lower sets is a basis for the Aleksandrov topology. So that if you have two lower sets, well, the union is trivially a lower set, and the intersection is simply defined . So this is an algebra inside here, and this is the lower set of it. And it's easy to show that this is a basis for a topology. Now, it turns out that with this topology, these two guys are actually isomorphic. Now, this is one of the exercises, but so in order to show that, yeah, I think the exercise, you have to show that this is the case. And you can obviously either get a pre-sheaf and show that this is the same as this. I mean, to define your sheaves, you can just consider each basis, right? Everything is just a unit. Or you can go through this process here. You pick a sheaf there, and then you do all that. And if you do that, you have to, the important thing is to note that for each algebra, this guy here is the smallest open set containing that algebra, right? And this is important up here, because you remember when you define the bundles, you define the bundles in terms of equivalence classes of germs. And two elements had the same germ at X if there exists a minimum open set on which they agree. I'm actually telling the result, but whatever. And the minimum open set would be this one. So anyway, that is one way of doing it. Okay. So what this means is that because you have this topology, so this Aleksandrov topology, these two topoi are the same. So what this means is that we don't have to change anything of what we've defined so far. So all the pre-sheaf that we've defined just carry through to sheaves over that category with Aleksandrov topology. All that changes is that now you acquire topological information. But the way you construct objects is equivalent because of this. Okay, so now this is all I want to say for that. We'll see when we do groups and probabilities, we'll see exactly how we're going to use this topos. But now I want to say something about geometric morphism, because they're gonna, where is it? Oh. Since they're gonna be important both when defining group transformations and when defining probabilities. Okay, before talking about geometric morphisms, I have to talk about joint pairs. So first we'll do that. Adjoint functors. So these are special type of functors which, when mapping objects between category, preserve certain relations. That's why they're important. Because if you do have an adjoint pair and you know something about a category, you automatically know a lot about the other. Okay, definition. So imagine you have two functors going between categories. These are adjoint if the following is satisfied. So this is D. You have an element here, and you have an arrow to the image of something. And then you have the image of this guy. A. What these adjoint functors do, they, well, obviously map. So what they do is that they map each morphis in G, which has a domain, an object in G, in D, sorry, and as a codomain, the image of G, to a map in C, which has the reverse. So what this means is that you have this bijection. For each of arrows, so for all x, where's x, d and a and c, you have this type of bijection. So you obtain an isomorphism. So for each map in your category D to an object, to the image of the G functor, you get a corresponding unique map in C from the image of your original element to the original element. And if this is the case, you say that F is left adjoint to G. So it's on the left. It's just a symbol. So you can already start seeing how this adjoiners relation really preserves constructs. Now, of particular importance are two
So the morphism in C is the image of small f? Or how, I mean, how are f and h related?
That to each, so this would be f and this would be h.
But h is not some image of f, right?
It's, the relation is between the domain and codomain. So for each element here, there will be an image. And from the image to A, they correspond a map from the original to the image.
H might be uniquely determined by F, but it doesn't have to be an image of little
yes.
F under big F.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So once you have this, you can uniquely determine H, but it's
then what's the wording? F is the adjoint of G. The left of the
big F, yeah.
And what happens if you also require that H, for example, is the image of F, little f on the big F?
So
if
H
then
is
you get
isomorphism.
Then you get isomorphism.
H is what, sir?
F of little f. Do you get isomorphism? Sorry.
H is, yeah, you do. So H would be F of X goes to F of G of
A.
Does that mean?
Yeah.
And you get something, we're gonna do what you get now. This is is a special, this is called it's called the co-unit. These are not in this lecture. Well, it's not really the co-unit, actually. I don't think you'll get isomorphism.
Is G then the right adjoint?
Yeah. Yeah, if one is the left pedal. So, okay, what's an example of this? Okay, so for example, so a special case is the unit of the adjunction. So in here, now imagine you get A equals to so you get X goes to G F of X. F of X goes to F of X. Now replacing. Now we've done this in the formula there. And this special element is called the unit of the junction. And it's the one map which for each element X, you map it to the identity. So, abstractly, it's from identity F of whatever to GF. So that if you apply this isomorphic map to this counit, well, again, you get this. You're confused. Oh, I did that the other way around. Oh, that's right. Is this confusing?
There it looks like either would be an arrow from X to G.
Sorry, the natural, the components. If you took away that, this would just be.
No.
Sorry, that's right. Sorry. So X belongs to D, yeah? So for each X, you get the component of this, which is a map from X to GF. I suppose maybe you should just write D. It's not really quite right. It's just that it gets the element and maps it.
So eta is a vector or natural transformation? Natural transformation.
Yeah. So for each object in D, so I suppose you get like this, it gives a transformed object, which F is from D to C and C to D. So this is all in D. Well, the components. Just think of it. Yeah, for each object, you get this. From the object, you kind of go back and forth and you map it. And this is the unique one, which when mapped in C, gives the identity. So here would be.
But then should be if eta maps the identity functor on D to the functor GF. And then the line above, like just eta without subscript, should map the identity functor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I wrote it before. I was getting mixed up. Yes. Yeah. Good. Okay, and then, so that is what it does, and it has a uniqueness property. I'm not sure how I wrote in the lectures. Anyway, that is right. The uniqueness property is that, okay, so let's start off with an F. No, I forgot to say the other one. Okay, we saw H, F of X to A. So this is down here, so you get an F, which is from X to G of A. And this unit of that junction is the unique map which makes this diagram commute. This is the unit. This is H, and this is now G of F. So everything has to be in D, right? So this map here, H, this is in C. But we know that indeed there's this corresponding map. And then you can also map your original H to G of H, which now is in C. And this diagram is all in C. And this map is the unique one which makes this diagram commute. So that's the co-unit, the unit. Now you have the dual of the unit, which is the co-unit, and you cannot start guessing. It just is the same, but everything now goes in D, the category D rather than the category C. So what's the co-unit? So now instead, to define the unit, we replace A with F of X. Now we're going to replace A with G of X. No. We need F, G of A. X with G of A. Up there, and you get to this. Now this is the co-unit. So this is the other way around. Here now we have the identity. And now we have down here the co-unit. So now it's C. Well, the other way around. F, G, to identity on C. This time it's like this. So to the identity, you get, or the other way around, I mean, to this, you get the identity, but now in C. And again, the co-unit is the unique map, which kind of allows you to do this. So and I have a similar drawing. Actually, the thing in the lecture notes I did it wrong. So I think I did cut and paste and then I didn't replace anything. So for the uniqueness of the counit, we have the following. They're given a map. There's that one. You get, and that's in D, you get a map in C. And the co-unit is the unique map such that this diagram commutes. So to this map in D, you get this in H, in C. But you also get one in C by applying the F functor to this guy. And you obtain this diagram. And the co-unit is the only one that makes this diagram commute. So it's the, again, is the only map which, if you apply this isomorphism, well, now the pullback gives you the identity. Obviously, with this replaced. So the unit and co-unit are important because they are the, because of this bijection, because this association is unique, there will be two unique arrows which get mapped to the identity. And these are co-unit and co-unit. Now, I realize that I forgot to say that this association is universal. And by this, I mean that if you have any other map which composes with it, then also that gives you a bijection. And obviously the same for unit and co-unit. So what I mean is the following. So we have this. That's the bijection. Now imagine you have a map like this. And then from A to... If you compose them, then you get yet another bijection. So you get this. And so the same here. If you had maps, then they will all factor through this. Same here. You've got these two maps. Any other composition factors through this to give yet another bijection.
Is it right to think of this as some kind of like weaker type of equivalence relation between categories? Because if C and D were equivalent categories, then these epsilons and these eta's would be like a natural isomorphism or something.
Yeah.
So since we don't have an isomorphism...
That's the closest you can get. Yeah. Yeah, that's precise. Yeah, it's a weaker... Yeah, it's precisely that. It's a weaker condition. And in fact, I mean, if it was isomorphic, everything would be respected. But in this case, the only thing that happens is that this guy preserves... limits, while this guy preserves product. So, so yeah, they're kind of equivalent up to a point. Okay, let's give an example. Yeah. Oh. Adjoint functors. So one is the exponential. So we've already defined the exponential, but you can also see it as coming from a certain type of adjunction. So what are the functors involved? So we consider two functors. So we have, first we give a category C where we have products. Given that, then we define two functors, both going to C, from C to C. One is this. And this just gets, so A also is in C. Yeah, it has products. So what this does, it gets an element and just defines a product. Then we get another map, always from C to C. Now you have to think of this going the other way. And this gets an element and defines the exponential. And we claim that these two are an adjoint pair. In particular, this guy is left adjoint to this. Now, if this is the case, then you get something like this, some relation like this. So you would get, okay, now, so that's G. So you get an element, well, in C. Then you get G of some other element, let's say G of, so G is this guy, is the right one, and this is the left one. G of some element, say B. And then you have F of this one, so this applied to this, plus C. And then your original one, which was simply B. Now, if you remember the definition of exponential, it was the case that there was this mapping. And in particular, if you get the co-unit of it, so if you get this guy, the co-unit in this case is F is A times. Of say B that goes to B. What this gives you is A times something B of A goes to B, and this is A times B of A, not B, sorry. No, that's right. And being the co-unit, this is the only map which makes this diagram commute. So, if you remember the can you see that? So if you remember the definition of a co-unit, which I deleted it. So, okay. So because of the definition of a counit, we know that to each map from, well, F is this guy, huh? Which is A cross C to B, is up there, the correspond an H. So there's the H down there, the correspond an F, which is C to G of this guy, which was B of A. And then what you obtain is, this is the counit map. This is this map here, and this guy would be the F of this, which is simply the identity times that. And this was the definition of the exponential. So the counit was the evaluation map. Here also I made a mistake, I wrote the unit map, square unit. So this adjunction comes about in a lot of cases. Another very simple one is actually more easy to understand, actually. The following. So again, if you have C and C times C, you can define the product. Product or the diagonal functor. So what the product does is, well, it takes two elements and it defines the product. Again, you require that the product exists in C. And the diagonal map goes the other way. It takes an element and it just gives two copies. It turns out that also these two are adjoint. In particular, this is left adjoint to this. So if this is the case, then applying that bijection there, you get an element, G of that element, G of what's some other element? This is F of this, goes to your original element. And that this is a bijection follows from the definition of a product. Right. So if you remember, we have this is the unique arrow such that this commutes and let's call HJ. This arrow here is precisely H. Yeah? J. So you can see that these are adjoints and the proof is the standard definition of a product. Anyway, these adjoints come everywhere, I think. they come about a lot. And precisely because they're very useful, because, as you said, this is the closest you can get to an equivalence, really. and they come about in a lot of contexts. And a particular one is the context of geometric morphism, which is what we're going to do now, which are basically maps between topoi. And the maps which whose definition rely on adjoint functors. So. What are they? So given to topoi. As the plural topos. Then a geometric morphism between them is a map between them, well, it's a functor, which is comprised of two elements. Of two elements which are joined to each other, the order preserving, the direct image functor and the inverse image functor. And these are adjoined to each other. And they, okay, that's the definition. So given to topoi, obviously if they're equivalent, then this is just, these two coincide. But if they're not, then you can define a map between them, a geometric morphism, which is defined of two maps, one which is the direct image and one that is the inverse image. And these two are left adjoints. That's the abstract. Now let's see for specific topoi, in particular for the ones that we were using, what that actually means. So first we define it on pre-sheaves, then on sheaves. So if you have two pre-sheaves, yeah. It comes from here.
Where is the left adjoint? It's called in series the left adjoint, which there's all kind of things.
So left exact. Oh yes, it has an extra property that is left exact. Oops. We'll have to check this. I don't remember if it. Okay, that is definitely right. I might have made a mistake here. Because then it would preserve absolutely everything. Okay, can I check this? Sorry. I don't remember if left exact preserves all finite limits. Oh, I don't remember. Okay, I need to check if I wrote it down right. Okay, I'll come tomorrow. Because then it would preserve absolutely everything. Okay, so. Imagine we have two topoi, and we want to define a geometric morphism between them. Now, a way of doing it is by first defining maps between the respective categories, and then pushing them up to maps between the topoi. So first you define a map from, it doesn't matter if C or whatever. then this translates functor in a geometric morphism. Well, actually it has to be like this. Which has direct image which is defined as follows. So you get a pre-sheaf here. You push it forward. And this is basically defined as your original pre-sheaf, now acting on whatever object that you obtain through this. Some so this guy here is in here, this guy is in here, but is defined by getting the original and mapping this to here. The inverse image does exactly the opposite. Now defines the original and the inverse of that. So you get a pre-sheaf. You define as a pre-sheaf in this other topoi, and this is a, and you act on some object. This is equivalent as the original one, but acting on the pullback of that object. Now you get exactly the same. This is for pre-sheaves. You get exactly the same for sheaves. Now you require that the map between the topological spaces has to be continuous. So now, if F continues, then you get a respective geometric morphism with this is defined exactly the same. It has inverse image and direct image, etc. etc. So basically, this is to say that when you're looking for sheaves and pre-sheaves, obviously, but when you're looking for geometric morphism, a source of them is by first looking at maps between the base categories or the topological spaces, and then those automatically translate in geometric morphism. Because this definition is just kind of trivial, right? And this. Okay, now we're going to look at an example of geometric morphism in our topos. And this will be a geometric morphism which, in the original formulation of quantum theory in terms of a topos, namely in terms of pre-sheaves, this is as far as one got in defining group transformations. And we'll see that it fails. But it's still, I mean, I have to show you why it fails. Okay, so what we want to do now is to define something that represents group transformation in this topos here. So I know I said that in order to do it, we need to go to sheaves, but first we see why it doesn't work here. Okay, so because it's per sheaves, we want to define group transformation in each context. So the first thing to check is how does the group act, this guy. So we know for each G, we normally consider unitary transformation. Then you obtain a transformation on your algebra, which is this. So it's basically you transform each operator in that algebra. And this for all. For one group element, I'm not considering all the groups, just one. So because of this, and you can do this for all algebra, what this means is that for one group element, you get a map from category to itself. So each algebra simply gives the unitary equivalent algebra. So we're here, where now the category is itself. So this means is that now you can go up to the level of topoi and define, I'll just call it the same, the geometric morphism. With the inverse image part, which is the one we're going to be interested in, well, it goes exactly the same way, because they're the same. But what this inverse image part does is the following. You get, let's take the state space, and it maps it to the transformed state space. Now, by definition, this is this guy. Right? So if you act on it on a context, you end up with your so-called twisted resheaf.
One is subalgebra of the other, but this doesn't apply to unitary transformations, does it?
It's not within the categories, between the categories. It's not an algebra. It's not an arrow in here.
Oh, so it's a function.
Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry. The category between the two categories.
Well,
I call it map here, sorry.
It doesn't really do anything with the maps, right?
Okay, so, and here's the problem, right? Because now you get something that is not very nice. So for each V, this guy here, which will simply denote UG, just to indicate that it's because of that transformation. So for each algebra, this presheaf gives the spectrum of something else. And so on and so forth. So that's why it twisted. Right? Instead of giving a spectrum of this, it gives a spectrum of something else, of a unitary equivalent algebra. So what this means is that for each element in your group, you get a different state space. And it's not what you want. I mean, both in classical physics, group transformation, you map Hilbert space, and classical physics from your state space, the state space. Here, what you end up is you start with a state space, you go to another one, you go to another one, and so on. Okay, they're unitary equivalent. I mean, they're isomorphic in this case, for us presheaves. But still, is not quite what you want.
Isn't this something you can kind of encounter in regular quantum theory? Because you could pretend that your Hilbert space at each time is different.
Mm-hmm.
They happen to be isomorphic, so they identify them as one.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah, but this...
It's probably a more radical difference where you're just...
You can't quite... because of this twist, everything gets muddled up when you define your states, when you define truth values, it all gets... you want something that does have a transformation, but it's within this, so that you can really... That's what you want to end up.
Oh, so the transformations are always within the sheets.
That's what you want.
Okay, yeah.
So you don't want N... sheaves which can be related by group transformation. Yeah, it's a little bit more different than just. It would be. I mean, if you could mimic it, it would be nice. But you really need a transformation from a state space to a state space, which still gives you a transformation, but doesn't take you out to another presheaf. That's the problem.
What do we need the group action for? Like the time evolution? Or like that?
Or any transform? I mean, you do want a group action if you try and do quantum theory. Yeah, mainly for group time evolution. I mean, this is one problem, then this is only for one G. And it turns out if you consider all Gs, then the action is not even continuous at the level of the categories. So it's all a bit messy.
That's not very good.
So for one G it's continuous, for the entire G it's not. So what we want to do, and look how we're going to the next lecture, is to see how by first going to sheaves, and then changing slightly the category we're going to work with, you can define a group action which doesn't give this twist. I mean, it solves that problem, but it makes things a little static. But yeah, we'll see it next slide. Basically, we get the twist, right? And more, I mean, we're really trying to make it more look like classical physics, so you would want to have something like that. I mean, this, what we're going to do next, actually, this is like the very last, latest results in this topic of quantum. This and probability is the latest result. It might be the case that somehow you can still use this, but it does create a lot of problems.
No, just for some. I mean, you want group action to be able to relate different contexts to each other, whereas because they should be connected through time evolution, or
no, just to define time evolution. Just you have, I mean, if you're trying to you're trying to describe quantum theory, so you have some transformation group, and you would want it to be something, an element in this. You want it to be a presheaf. which acts on proposition, on states, and on the state space, etc., etc. Just like normal group theory.
Yeah, but so in say, in the Heisenberg picture, asking some questions different. I mean, the operator is involved, so I would just have expected that this refers to picking different contexts at different times, for example. Just because if I ask the same question at T0, I need to use another context than when I ask it at T1.
Yeah, you can, yes.
So for these relationships.
Then you want to relate those two things?
Yeah.
By some symmetry action?
I mean, you have to abstract. You can define with each context, but our objects are these guys. So group actions. It is defined context-wise, but this is our object. The group actions.
Actually, couldn't we do something on the level of do a Schrodinger picture, where we just only modify for our propositions?
Mm-hmm.
They can kind of carry time. Values, or they could, you could act the group on our propositions and stuff, because you could just say, okay, well, say I have a state psi at time 0,
mm-hmm.
at time t I have psi of t, and I look at the corresponding pre-sheaf from that one. You can do, I guess, the same with the truth objects and stuff.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. You can, so what is being done is that you mean sorry, let me see if I understand.
Then
so
just have your group act on the Hilbert space
on
and out of the algebra, basically.
On the what space?
On the Hilbert space, yeah. On the side. Yeah, I think you're...
So, you have this guy?
Yeah.
Okay,
uh-huh.
Okay.
Yep.
So, and then you would have, with it, T.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would have T1. Okay.
Yeah.
This is being done, and then... That's a good question. Because if you do that, you can have a history. I mean, you have to still consider all of them. We can consider this at T1, but then... you see what I mean? So it would be different topoi.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that, and then you can... you can also tensor them. And this guy here is actually 18 algebra. The tensorfold of 18 algebra is itself 18 algebra. So this is a proposition in... would be in this here. Well, actually, no. And this, you can also have a state. So 1, t, 2, etc., etc. This you can do. The only problem, I mean, you can do it okay. The only problem is when you. Comment?
Doing continuous time might be a pain.
Quite. And that's the problem. I mean, it is okay. For example, if you have just this guys, then this you can evaluate. It kind of breaks down. But when you get an entangled context, you still get a proposition, a truth value, but you lose the individual informations.
Okay.
So you can say something like it's true at some time, but you don't know which one.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I mean, just one more. I mean, we used machines to encode states because they kind of give us different answers depending on which classical context we take, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important to also have these group actions, say when it stands for a time evolution,
mm-hmm.
as a sheaf or pre-sheaf, and not just a relation among the classical contexts?
Because, you're using this maths. You have to, I mean, sure, you can have for each G, that's the closing thing, for each G you have this. Which is in a way a relation between classical context, but if you want to really use this as your mathematical universe, a group has to be an element in here. You are inside it. Mm-hmm. If I'm understanding, so you're saying that you just give some relation between the categories.
I mean, in the end, we need time evolution or spatial symmetries,
mm-hmm.
just to, I would say, time solution, you could get better rid of it, just specify at what time we ask the question, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then this would totally go into the choice of classical context.
Mm-hmm.
Now say, like, a spatial symmetry is only a relationship between different classical contexts, which say are just rotated by an angle towards each
mm-hmm.
other. So it would somehow be some equivalence relation between a set of classical contexts.
Okay.
I mean, I would expect all of this to only take place in the category of von Neumann subalgebras.
Okay.
But I don't see how this needs to take place in our topos.
Well, so you say that each will be precisely, I mean, you have your algebra, then you do something to it, what you're saying? So that you get some symmetry transformation.
I mean, our topos only is based on this V of H,
yeah.
And maps this somehow into, or it maps this into sets.
Yes.
So if you now want to understand the group action as a functor between, as a functor from our base category to the base category itself again, I mean, no wonder that this can't be mapped into free sheaf, because suddenly we are doing a functor between, like, on our...
Well, so you're mapping this thing to some other basis.
Yes, to some other base.
But then you still want free sheaves. I mean, your object is this guy. So whatever you do on the basis will have repercussions up there, because you're defining your object as...
Okay, so number one, because why are evolutions or symmetries really actions on the base space, or are they just some inherent relations, structures in our base category?
I suppose both. I mean, they're the same categories, but... Oh, okay, so you say that you call this, and then this would be the time t1, and this would be the time t2. That's what you're saying. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure, because then you would have your state space would be something. I mean, this is true because these are the same categories. But ascribe, I wouldn't know. So
I mean, this seems to me like basically a Heisenberg picture, right? We have for each time, for each classical context, and each time we choose, we have one phonemic subject. So I don't. I don't see the need why we need to encode a time evolution as a functor that has to be compatible with our prefixed structure.
Okay, so if you defined like this, then some would be. I think you would have real troubles in defining sheaf maps here.
We wouldn't have these sheaf maps because we don't necessarily have an inclusion map. Because we could change.
Oh, actually, you wouldn't have
something
in that case.
Okay.
Right. Unless, okay, so G would be to the stability group, or the fixed point group, or in those cases, you might have an inclusion.
So for each time, we have like a set of contexts, which are like our thing is a section of a set of contexts for each time, and then for each time, we have a separate such set. Is that what you're saying? For each time we have a family of contexts, and a state is
a
section.
Yeah, or you start with a context, and then you would have another context for each time. Just you would to label
like
your context.
A state is like a section of a context, right?
Yeah. Can you describe the state with just one context?
No,
like
you can't.
Fixed
time? That's like the point of.
Yeah.
I think classic contexts. Is basically which classical observables do you want to ask from the system.
Mm-hmm.
So we would say we want a positional operator, and then we have to specify it, but at what time. So we would have to ask the system at this time, what does the position operator do? So by this, I would see a subalgebra there in the base category for every instance of time. They are labeled by our set of observable, and by time, or and by space.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have an issue with redundancy and stuff though as well. I mean, we're going to have a lot of algebras that are exactly the same.
I'm interested, it's quite external, this labeling is not something that is natural
yeah.
in the topos. I mean, you have to label topos.
But it is there anyway.
You can just take the set of all algebras,
I mean,
cross R.
Yeah,
I mean,
you can always put
that's
the
Heisenberg picture, right? That's the Heisenberg picture.
Yeah, we know the basic thing. The thing is to translate this into something which fits naturally only in one context, in one language.
Yeah.
If it doesn't fit too well, you can suspect mm-hmm. that something is wrong. If you're really, if you have a lot of faith in the project.
Yeah, so you would have something like that, right? It just seems you're very external. You want. Honestly, I've never done this. Because the idea is to, once you have the state space, to. If you do have this as your base character, to redo everything. Right? Your states, your state space, the truth values.
You're going to have kind of strange sheaves, because if you want to say a proposition at a specific time, you need to say it only has support on that given time, and it has to be like zero elsewhere.
Yeah, you would get a strange object.
But still, if you think of the two-state system, which is some time evolution, we have all these instances at different times. Within our just within we of age, right? We age is a collection or is a set of operators, like is a subalgebra.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking the Heisenberg picture, we have anyway already in just v of age, not tensor to a cross product,
mm-hmm.
but anything, already all of the subalgebras we need at any given instance of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if they have some time illusion, they're just another
algebra stack.
They are already all in there. We just have to identify, depending on our system, some relationships between these different, like the structure of this V of H.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just worried about how you can really well define for sheaves and sheaves, if you put everything already here, because then there'll be some defined at the time. I mean, the Prashiv is a consistent assignment, and somehow you will have to select some which are consistent at the time and then some at other times, and then some maps between them. I'm not quite sure how to do that. I don't know the answer. I think it might be a little bit complicated to define sheaves like this.
I mean, mathematically, they are the same. One might just need to put more work into defining propositions. Well, more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Every unitary evolved thing is ready, yeah? But you would have to... Yeah, you have to put extra structure which indicates what time you're doing things.
Yeah, how
and
you
I'm
go
not
from
sure
one
this,
to the other.
Huh?
And how do you go from one time to...
Yeah.
to
And I don't know if you can do
what
it.
What kind of an object is that?
Yeah, I'm not sure you can really. I mean, I'll have to sit down and try to do it, but I don't think you could do it as a pre-sheet.
So it's like in case you accidentally apply a unitary from a subcontext to a subcontext within the same sheaf rather than to another time or something, what would that. Like, you'd have to prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you want to label the elements so that they do the time things correctly, you're exactly putting a group action on the thing anyway. I mean, if you say like, okay, write my list of algebra that's fixed from the beginning and will basically always be fixed, but I want to say this algebra is the time evolved of this algebra. So I can say like, you know, I can label each one with a list of, you know, all the things. Like, okay, it's this algebra at T, you know, this one at T1, this one at T2, and all this stuff. But if you have all of that data and you want to make it consistent, you basically just put a group action on your algebra like we started with.
And I don't know if there's another language of doing that, but you somehow want to encode the fact that this algebra is the evolute of this one, and this one's the evolute of that one, and this one evolves into this one.
Yeah.
And that's the structure you want there, and I think the exact language for that is a group action
on the
algebra.
Yeah. Because that automatically translates to this. If you don't want to sit there and just have labelings, just labelings. Honestly, don't think you would get a well-defined sheaf.
Don't we?
Go ahead.
And even if you do this with time, if you have a rotation, you have to label things with angles.
Mm.
I mean, what's special about time?
Mm.
I mean, it's special, but it's not that special.
Yeah,
you
and
could,
then you would have to imagine that, yeah.
And you have to do that for every symmetry you can think of, however simple.
Yeah, I think you'd get a very complicated sheet.
There is something, you might be able to do stuff on the proposition side, it just might be really complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing you might, but the easiest way is just to try and define something as a group and just make it happen. Which then automatically would act also on this, obviously. But it would act on that whole on the entire object.
Could it be that the group action would select certain...
certain content?
Yeah, certain context that is invariant and there's something and that gives you some sense of... I don't know if it was just random stuff.
And we have the stability
group. Yeah,
sure. I mean, any thoughts? I mean, there is a way of solving it by... but I don't know. We'll do it tomorrow, I'm not sure how it is. And this has just been done. If you have any other ideas, because as you'll see tomorrow, it makes things a little bit overly complicated. Well, I'll we'll see it tomorrow. But if there's any other way, that'd be great. Yeah, this group action is quite.